Brian Steeden's first collection of poems, Last City, is forthcoming from Carnegie Mellon University Press in next year. His work has appeared in the Beloit Poetry Journal, Harvard Review, Tri-Quarterly, Virginia Quarterly Review, and other publications. Published internationally in magazines in Greece, Albania, and Serbia. And he translates modern Greek poetry. His translation of Phoebe Genisi's poetry collection, Homerica, is forthcoming from an inaugural series of world poetry books soon, 2017, or is it already out?
A few more months, yeah. So they tell me. So.
He received his MFA from the University of Virginia, where he held the Poe Faulkner Fellowship in Creative Writing and served as poetry editor for Meridian. He's the senior editor of the New Poetry in Translation. And looking around for a poem that I wanted to just to get my hands and eyes and ears around, I came up with this, which is online, and I wanted to read it by means of introduction. It's called, and maybe he'll read or talk about it. I found it a pretty interesting poem. It's called Reconstruction. And it starts with this epigraph by Sherman, General Sherman, to the mayor of Atlanta. And he says, "But my dear sirs, when peace does come, you may call on me for anything. Then will I share with you the last cracker." And I had to laugh at that because, you know, the last cracker has a lot of different connotations. Yeah. The poem goes, "They put their guns in the only boxes that they had, and those the well-liquored stripes of gin barrels wrapped in hemp, and buried them in the troughs of their once fields of burnt clay. The black went down 6 feet, so they said, until one of the shovels struck a hemp root, the last root in Georgia," which is in italics. "And threw them in while reciting from a Bible something about the Canaanites. Thought about the barrels rusting in their musty barrel woods. Everyone could play the fiddle, but those were gone with the woodwinds. So they sat one by one and talked about the acrid earth in their mouths, like burnt bread as one hummed a Negro song, and the others, finding they could speak the words, began to sing loudly, howling, until one said, 'Shit, son, you think we're trying to call them back.'" Brian called us because he's doing work on Olson, and anybody who's doing work on Olson, we tend to want to come up, have them up to Gloucester. So his research on the poetry of Olson has primarily been involved examining the use of the apostrophe and other semiotic forms of the enunciative address in the Maximus poems. He's particularly interested in how his usage of the indeterminate you throughout the poem establishes what Jonathan Cutler calls lyric temporality via triangulated address between the I of the speaker and the you of the address and the reader who overhears the kit and caboodle. Brian Steeden.
You have such a wonderful husky voice. I wonder if you could read the rest of what I brought.
That's because of my post-nasal drip, though.
Thank you all very much for having me tonight. It's been a pleasure to spend these last few nights in Gloucester. And I will do my best to read the poem that actually brought me to Gloucester, if I can find it on my... This is not for fashionable purposes, I promise, but necessity. I may read it off my cell phone, so I apologize. But everything else I will have in print here. I didn't realize at first that Gloucester was an island. separated by the river that I still haven't quite learned to pronounce. What starts with an A, correct?
Anasquam.
Yes, thank you. It that brought to mind the opening of the British author Lawrence Durrell, his book A Marine Venus, which begins with this idea of a disease that certain people have called eilomania. This is a disease that people who must live on islands, they just have to be surrounded by bodies of water. And of course, it's a very romantic idea. He argued that it's because they have some gene descended from the stragglers of Atlantis many thousands of years ago. So I grew up on an island as well. And I've oftentimes, the name of my first collection of poems is called Last City. But there's just as many islands as cities in it. So I feel like for me, this is one thing that I do have in common with the Maximus poems, the island and the city kind of being the same body that is often addressed. But enough talk. So I'll read some island poems. This is called New Year on Pleasure Island. What I did not know to make made itself in vestigial hours between 2 o'clock and dawn, when the shapes of birds stitched together in my mind, and a single cicada peels the air. Each letter I write returns to water. I start one now, and already the flashy ceiling of a sentence begins to fade, and I am left with nothing but the island and its circuitous thought, like the bulb shards of sunsets in the reeds. Without going to the place I had to go, without any of the particular things I was told that I needed to make my life, I walk again down this desolate bank, sitting with the occasionally given happiness of a saucer with the last opaque drops, fingered as the wet sand is fingered by a blue roving thumb. There is no set time for the clouds to lose their inherited gold, no moment when the wind will stop and the stenciled islands far out melt into an even line. The last of the season inserts its sun-wide button into the waiting hole. The year is closed. This is a poem called Squatters. And it was written for a communal house that I lived next to in Asheville. I think at the time there were 17 people living there. There was one particular room which was always in disrepair, and so they always joked that it was the room for the rain. Needless to say, the roof wasn't particularly well thatched or well put together. So I thought there was a poem in that. So this is that poem. Squatters. By doing nothing, they are building a room for the rain. In April, sparrows fly in. October, and they rake the leaves into a wall to give the silence something to do. Sometimes one of them will hear music coming from behind the door, but when he looks to see, it is only the cold night sky. When they sleep, noises come out, like hands unfolding from the stone, a slur of bare feet, or the clink like a thrush prodding an invisible hole. After 10 years, it is theirs, all of it. The gardens and the sinks, the broken window in the small ruined wall looking out on another window, the dead lovers Moreau and Renaud, still loitering on the stairs, hoisting the same transparent jug of wine. All of it but the room for the rain, with the roof half eaten by the bright mineral light of the moon. This is called The River of the Given. Let it go, that which you gave to me. Put it in the water and let it float or sink as it can, without our help, without our touching it each time the old need arises and the reaching muscle starts again. Put it in the water and see if it folds to one side or manages to pull along straight and even on top of its own reflection, with its bright string attached to the edge of something far out. Without nourishment, without the miraculous human DNA threading its tiniest bone to ours, watch and see how far it goes on the food of its own breath, like a pharaoh bundle drifting among the finger bumps of the reeds. Give it back to where you found it, beneath the foam and debris, weighing less than its shadow on the air, before you spoke it a body and the rest, heat, noise, name, times when you did not know you touched, and an invisible blood passed into the thought and grew heavy until it sprouted hair, teeth. Put it in the water now and let it go, to where the river starts over, to where the parts of us gradually flake off, and it can be again someone's food, someone's joy. So that's a very strange metaphysical poem that I usually give an introduction to, but I decided to go ahead and barrel through. So that was the sort of brainchild of a conversation that I had at a bar several years ago with this fellow. oftentimes, those of you who are poets, if you're in a bar and somebody asks you what you do, and if you have the courage at that particular time to say poet, you either get very amused or very, very concerned inquiries that follow. But this was a particular fellow. He was like, oh, of course, I'm a poet too. And I wrote this poem. Would you like to hear it? So, of course, I said yes. And it was about this interesting idea that feelings were actual creatures that we couldn't see. That sort of floated around. So I decided I would plagiarize the thought, if not the poem, and kind of give it that particular shape. So, sort of along that thread, this is a poem called Goodbye Harvest. And it's playing with the idea of harvesting various aspects of one's life. And when you come to a point of harvest, the thing harvested can be part of yourself, part of your identity, your past, who you see yourself as belonging to. So that's what this is intended to address. Goodbye Harvest. Often the girl sitting alone on the roof. Often the cat in heat. Often the rim of the bucket growing mold after a death in the house, still waiting to be taken out so death cannot wash his sword in it. Often he washes his feet on the roof with his hair falling out over the village in moonlight. Do you remember the moonlight? Often the bird singing with the string in its throat. Often the empty furnace and the snow which makes you younger. often the late shadow. Often the stain which circles in the wine, after a death in the house, like a ballet shoe crusted in rosin. Waiting, often, the woman sitting alone on the rock, wearing only the howl of a dog, washing her village in darkness, her hair falling out over the water, at Morgos, where shipwrecks grow like wheat. Often my goodbye harvest of twice broken things, emptied in the sea. Do you remember the sea, waiting to be taken out? So those of you who have taught creative writing, or specifically poetry, there's two themes that I feel like often tend to come up. Sex being one, of course, regardless of the age group you're teaching, and death being the other. So when teaching, I often try to do the exercises that I assign in order to kind of keep up with how the particular explorations of the class develops throughout a given semester. So this is one in the death category. Valentine's Day is behind us, so we will avoid the loved ones for now. This is a poem called Mist Burial. And the epigraph is, I bury you in the heron's eye. Who will tell me when the birds come again to Patmos, singing the song of bitter lemons over the water, or when a fisherman pulls up some statue from the harbor caught in his net, Our Lady of the Vanishing Sorrow, Lady of the Forgotten Name, with half of her face eaten by drachma fish and moonlight. Who will say at night, when the spark of a woman lighting a match in a doorway opens for a moment, the sea, like a goat herd's lamp in a field at night, drunk, stumbling in alertness, or whether the cigarette brightens the vacuum of her mouth like grape leaves. At dawn, the last boat comes back with urgent news for someone, and the air changes inside the porticos, around the hands pressing open and closing the shutters. Who will say which silence has taken root? And if it is the same one, you told me, grows at the foot of the volcano, once a lifetime, and when it ripens, takes the voice of a young girl and buries it, half in the air and half in the sea. So I guess I'm feeling a little homesick, so I'll read a poem that involves mountains. For a long time, I lived in the city of Asheville, North Carolina, which was actually where my interest in Charles Olson and Black Mountain College grew, because Lake Eden nearby in Black Mountain was, of course, the location for their college. And while I was there, I often wrote at a place which I later learned was where the same library where Olson began the Maximus poems. So that was an exciting discovery that I made fairly recently. But there's several mountains here which are positioned very, very close to Black Mountain, one of which is Shining Rock, which if you haven't been there, I highly recommend it. It's a giant outgrowth of quartz. So you see it from a distance, and it's like this glaring bright. It's almost like a fire on the mountain. So this is a poem called The Temple. And this is actually the oldest poem in my collection of poems, which is coming out soon. I wrote this when I was 21 or 22, I think, so sticking around. I have wanted a body that, like a cathedral bell, could survive several years with one glowing note still resounding beneath the skin. I have wanted a body that, like kudzu, would not stop growing. The old men at the coffee house, nursing 10 thermoses with wrists now brittle and dry, they should be great trees, warrior-colored oaks, gaunt as ancient samurai, their hard-earned muscles still frightening. The morning I hiked from Tennant Mountain to stand barefoot on shining rock, I felt naked, the quartz humming like a chapel full of whispers. I could have come from any century. The memory of Crete, sitting in the cave where Sybil taught Hercules how to hold a woman's heart, slowly, like the song of a white crane. I wanted a body that could sit like a growth of quartz, sacrificing nerves for a skin that echoes, patiently waiting on nothing in particular. I wanted a body that, like Valmiki's, could sit 9 years in the Himalayas, ants building their mound to the crest of his bald head, watching thoughts form slow as seasons, the mountain sweetening his insides like a blood orange until, at last, fully ripened by stillness, the earth eats him. So the fellow Valmiki, some of you may be familiar with, he is the poet who is attributed to writing the Hindu text, the Ramayana. And he was very distraught by civilization, as often occurs to poets, not just poets, of course, and went and sat for 9 years at the bank of the Ganges River. And he sat so long that ants built their nest to over his head. So there's actually a wonderful drawing in the William Buckland version of the Ramayana, where you just see this anthill and these two eyes peeking out. So he was there for a long time until, you know, taking in his surroundings. And when a lovebird began to sing and court another lovebird, so the male lovebird and the female lovebird, they came together. They were singing. They were doing their courtship dance. Things were going well. There may have been some Barry White. I don't know. But a hunter came out of nowhere and shot them both. And so Valmiki tore off the anthill. He hadn't moved in 9 years, and he issued the world's first poem, apparently, which was a curse on this hunter for ruining this love. So it's interesting when you look at how, like, when you think of the world's first poems and from various cultures. And for instance, in Greece, you have Apollo, who is, you know, the god of poets there. For him, the reason why we have laurel and laureate as a descriptor and a decoration of poets was because he chased Daphne, who was a water nymph and then turned into a tree. So in order to sing his heartbreak, he then wore the laurel. So this is a common denominator, and I'm always fascinated in this kind of, I guess, going back to death and sex, but also just in general how this kind of type of loss is the foundation text for poetry in so many different cultures. Speaking of Greek, I guess this is a good time to read a translation if you would be interested. So I was very fortunate last May to meet in Columbia University a Greek poet by the name of Phoebe Yannisi. And she has several books out. She has six, actually. And this was, I believe, her fifth book. It's called Homerica. And it came out in 2009, but she has yet to have a collection published in English, so, prior to mine, which is coming out soon. So that's always exciting. But what drew me to her work in particular, aside from being able to meet her, was that she emulated or and brought out in her poetry so much of the sort of like densely elusive classical mythology that you find in Greek poets such as Sepphoris and Cavafy, and you see it throughout English language poetry, as you see in the Maximus poems and, of course, the Wasteland and the Cantos, and other kind of central texts in English language poetry. So I immediately felt a kinship with that, the aspect of her work. But I also was intrigued by the way that she actually doesn't write her poems necessarily. She composes them through speaking and then kind of writes them after the fact. And of course, that's marvelous to do in Greek, which is a language full of polysyllabic words. It's very easy to rhyme. You can open a window and immediately rhyme five words in Greek. So that's one thing that, as a translator, I often struggle with. Like, how do you not have this come off as a Hallmark card? So I often will use internal rhyme to do that. But this is a poem called Ithaca, Ithaca 1. And this is actually, we just started a press, a letterpress at UConn called Ithaca as well. And it involves, each year we're going to produce 150, so small run editions of a poem in translation. And this one is particularly interesting because it's all the Phoebe's handwriting that has been put to press. So by all means, I'll pass this out here in a minute. And I have some for sale if you're interested as well. But this is a poem which I feel like kind of embodies so much of what she's doing with contemporary poetics and classical kind of motifs. So Ithaca 1 by Phoebe Yanisi. At the end of the long table, foreign dinner guests, wine, your head shrouded, listening with tears to the song. I hear you leaving, becoming a stranger, a dream I had in front of the TV. Your language does not belong to me, telling the story, opening your mouth. The stranger wants to be sent back with chests full of gifts, on a night like this one, blindfolded, with a crew pulling at the oars, and the boat sleep, before turning to stone, will tie off in beach sand, by the origin of waters, bee jars, the games of little girls, and the grotto with its two doors, fame and forgetting, will accept him without a word, dressed in sheets between silence and silence. So that's the marvelous Greek poet Phoebe Yanisi. Shall I do a few more? Do we have time?
Yes.
Is it fantastic? Okay. I guess we never left the island, but this is a poem called The Island. The island here in question being Ireland. Country/island. This is off the west coast. Those of you who have been there, the Cliffs of Moher. On the southern end of the ridge of the Cliffs of Moher, there is a wonderful cliff called Hag's Head, which looks the part if you ever go there. And this was a time that I actually managed to go camping there, and it was very windy. So that was my prelude to the wind of Gloucester, I suppose. The Island. Beneath Hag's Head, the water rises, and white caps against streaks of bird shit and shrimpy mud, as the island floats into view and is gone. For 3 days, bad weather. Then one morning, rainbows off the cliff edge, like a trick of metallurgy. Wind peels bees off the heather, squeezes the yew to its whitest sap. If I told you that I saw it, out beyond the ninth wave, forked and sloping as the fluke of a mink whale, and unmoving like an inch of green lichen on gray-blue slate, would you say I was weak to stay on land. The mist closes as a staggered line of puffins needles a pure white tunnel through the fog. And 300 feet below, the waves gather their dead into a wall with frescoes of ice. So this is a poem that I'm reading as a memorial for a friend who passed away several years ago. Just a few weeks ago was the memorial. So this is a poem called After a Suicide. Taking with you some memory of the crab apples, of London and the cemetery fog, you in a corner of the room, looking out the bay window with all the nearly blue light on your face. Did you hear it when it came? The breath most precious for being last. Before it pressed slowly out and through the groove of the keyhole, out onto the lawn, like a hand of flute music stirring the carcass of a bee. Is it so terrible, finally? Or as they say, all pomegranates and ferrymen, the strict bloodless moon each day on the underground lake, afterlife in the darkness of tubers. Are you cracking jokes now on your sad long way to Mount Katahdin? But perhaps you are born already, a gloved hand pulling you out, fresh and sinewed as a newly bit nectarine. Your pink butt smacked hard as all the air and death bends into a child. What is there left to do now but thank you? Thank you forever giving me to you. Thank you for dying on time. So I'm going to read part of this poem for Garrett, who I found out yesterday is a fellow Durrellian, Lawrence Durrell, the Alexandria Quartet being a formative text, it seems, for us both. One of my big influences is the Greek poet Kavafi, who is referred to in the Alexandria Quartet as the old poet. He's sort of the Whitman-esque haunting figure throughout the streets of the poem, or of the book, sorry. But it is sort of a long poem, wouldn't you say, perhaps? So this is the second half of a longer poem called Alexandria Duet. And this is the part devoted specifically to the Greek poet Kavafi. And if you're not very familiar with his work, I know there's some books here. I think right over there, I've been enjoying them as well, some various versions. He's quite an interesting fellow. He's been well translated as well. So, this is from Alexandria Duet. 2. Kavafi. In his alcove, the Alexandrian, slim, mustached, pours chalk from a silk bag into a glass, watches the light dissolving flare of the city's granules like mullein dust in the glass bottom of his mind. In it, one person crosses a screen, meets another like blue-fibered ghosts in pipe smoke. One speaks, you can see the mouth moving, and the other grows imperceptibly heavier, like a palm frond in no air. They gesture and slow. Then one forgets, the other forgotten, and new figures swirl onto the screen of his mind as the city goes on rehearsing. In the darkness of apples, in the rooms with walls of ochre daylight, where the last drop in the left-out cups hardens to shadow, and the white dress hung on the line is used to wrap day-old meat. What he has left to say is windows, bottles, a bulb going on or out, the spare ingredients of the city, dissolved, worn thought thin, mindful of the slow progress of bird shadows, the folded echo of a drop dime, and the occasional tremble attributed to a train or car which barely dips its finger in your tea, flutters the back wall of the pantry like a saucer turned into a moth, and is felt by other cities, the seismic palpitations of the dead scraping their heels on the river's glass. From one dead city to another, from one live city comparing dead, whose each green-tinged elevator wire circles with dead like dust. Now he drinks from the river that runs through both cities, the living and the dead, falling off the edge of one in brownish strings, falling down through time or up, catching on the air that dresses each water, where he drinks the city from his hands. So pretty surreal there at the end, but thank you for bearing with me. So I'll just do two more. This next poem is called Last City, and it's the title poem for my first collection. And the city here is, it's sort of the city also that Olson begins to bring in towards the end of the Maximus poems, which is all cities. It's a sort of radical solipsism, where you're bringing in a city which could be at one time, you know, the city you grew up in, as well as Paris or Rome, various times, time periods, and so on. It's also death. So, of course, like, I guess there's a death theme going on tonight. I apologize for that. I hope it's not too overbearing. But in this poem in particular, the urge came from a Kavafi poem called The City, where he talks about, in a very didactic manner, there is no new land, there is no new sea, the city will follow you. So this idea of a city that haunts you, and it's of course an actual place, but that place is almost a prop and a stand-in, I think, for the sort of city of identity and mythology that we create, that we carry with us. So this is, this poem is called Last City. Perhaps it is the matter of going out which bothers me, that you or I or someone we know will have to get up wearing only the warmth of the memory of our clothes and find an airy socket in the car-fumed street. They say it is possible for those who go quickly or who are born with only one soul to slip out with dignity from the back row at an opera and into a black cab with plush seats and tinted windows full of aquarium lights. But what about the rest, the underdressed millions forced to rise and leave with the curtains still up and the sound of someone's voice lingering on the air? Do they file one by one into the street, leaving behind a pair of gloves or a half-touched glass of wine, waiting for no one to arrive and offer to pay the fare? But then, who's to say that you and I, busy making small talk with someone or another on the last sidewalk, couldn't manage to find a road of our own and a ride. Oh, gosh. Where is my phone? I think it's in my coat. Sorry. So this last poem is a sea shanty of sorts, which didn't know quite when to stop. So it's seven parts. It began very rhythmically and then ended up telling a story which I've yet to fully quite understand. But it is titled Victory at Sea. And it's a bit long, but it's the last one, so hopefully... and there's seven sections, so you can count along if need be. But thank you very much. It's been a true pleasure. Victory at Sea. 1. A branch and a body float by the same law. But does the voice change after the silhouette is dragged up from the floor? And the shadow is fed 2 drops of sunlight. 2. See them in lines stretching out from the harbor, veering a little left if the wind is good. Oars spindly at a distance, in hard diagonals, every other one a casket rowing. The wind mingles both. The voices of the living and the dead. I know. Each morning I wake early to shave the faces of the dead, but first I clean my razor and salt and make the proper excesses to divinity. Each launch brings back a torrent of envelopes. So many envelopes, like fish quivering and the other nets. 3. I do not believe in ghosts, but ghost ships raise up from the harbor once a week, mass prodding as they circle and cove like lost dogs. The moon does not answer them. The men wetting the foam with piss at the docks do not see them, or think that they see their own ships, night-fleshed and stout, dragging one by one the edible root of forgiveness, and feeling suddenly the wind enter through gaps in the ribbing. 4. After all, we are, like the fog, 9/10 seawater, give or take a dram. It is no pain to fill in the remaining, to carry the seeds of the breath to the surface to be planted. 5. The night brings back ships, anchors, posts green with oysters, things lost long ago. An emerald pin, a frothy pearl at the tip of a cufflink, luminescent like a votive candle at the bottom of the bay. Spit olive pits and wine, thickened water, all of it, return to the drawers, the tables, the pockets of coats suspended on pegs touched long ago, and the ship put back by waves. The hole in the roof folded over, again, the planks salt-worn, the balcony with its pots of herbs replanted, and the going hand of the fisherman who walked out from the deck with 2 glasses and tossing one into the sea, asked for nothing. 6. No time is needed for the vein of your thirst to rust. No time is needed to subtract your weight from the sea. No time for the ship put back by waves to be opened again by waves. 7. Today I walked to the beach, picking scalps for gold pins, passing through the pockets like a wind disturbing nothing, and saw something like snow down to the breakers. It took me half an hour to realize it was glass, a field of glass, glinting everywhere. Of course, I said, cutting, the war was made of glass. How else could it fit inside so many envelopes? Thank you very much.